This is Edge Cases. I'm Andrew Pontius.
And I'm Will French.
And our topic this week is how to get started on a project.
Oh, okay.
So we've got some follow-up, or FU. The first thing is a couple people have been getting on my case, understandably, that I never got around to mentioning the link for the Big O Notation Apple WWDC presentation. And I couldn't get you the link back when the episode took place. And let's see. That was... well, it was the episode was called Testing Whether You Believe in Fairies, episode 58, where I talk about job interviewing. And that was when Apple's ADC website was down. Mm-hmm. And it took a while for it to come back up. So actually, the first time somebody asked, I had to say, well, I still can't get that link because I can't get to I can't get to the videos. But even after it was up, I forgot to get to it. And so now I am getting to it. And mm-hmm. it was the WWDC 2013 video, 224, Designing Code for Performance. And I will put the link in the show notes for that. Now, I was hoping that the links to videos would be the same for every year. Because I did put a link. Yeah, you know where this is going. I put a link to something, from 2010 in an older episode. And, once I found out what the number was, I'll just punch in the number into that format, and then I'll get a new link for 2013, and that'll work. And, of course, it doesn't work. They're not using the same thing. So I'm using a different link, and that appears to be a link to just WWDC rather than WWDC 2013. So they haven't shifted the 2013 videos to their own specified year, which mm-hmm. maybe they'll do when there's a 2014, which mm-hmm. long way around of saying this video link will probably break, unfortunately. Sorry about that. Not too much I can do about it right now. But yes, it is there. It is 224. And it's got some slides in there about Big O Notation and performance characteristics and things like that, which should be very helpful to people who are interested in that sort of thing. So I hope that satisfies all of you and you will stop tweeting me about it.
I kind of want you have Bitly and you have Twitter has its own TCO links and all that. It's like, yeah. I almost want when we link to Apple and developer.apple.com that we would link to a third party site that yeah. would encode the current date into the URL. Yeah. And then it could be a community crowdsource thing where as yeah. Apple breaks the links every other day, we could fix it up.
We could fix it up. Yes. Who would do that? Who do you think would do that for no pay?
I'm volunteering you.
Yeah. Right. Well, thanks. I believe I would decline that honor. Sorry, Academy. I believe I would have to decline that honor. It might work if there's enough people, but it would be really thankless work. And
sure.
And and then when it breaks, it would be like any other open source project where if it breaks and you don't know even where to look for the links, then all you get to do is just complain about, instead of just complaining about Apple now, you'd also complain about the project, which is not doing the work. Mm-hmm. So I'm skeptical.
Okay.
There, as in so many other things. And so there was also a bit about your file systems episode, which right. was last week, which is If You're a File System Geek, episode 59. Mm-hmm. And Wolf, you had found this link. Someone had tweeted us a link, Matt Connolly, actually, saying, don't shout at your servers, which was something that you had talked about.
Right. And I could not hunt down that link, so I'm really glad that Matt was able to dig that up.
Did you mention that you did, I guess, right?
I mentioned it on Twitter, but yeah.
No, I mean, did you mention it in the episode? You didn't?
No, that I couldn't find the video anymore? No, I didn't.
Okay. But yes, I did listen to the video. It was funny. And so you've actually added it to the episode 59 show notes, mm-hmm. and which is fine. But
it's
I also
a
like
cardinal sin.
well, so I know I mentioned somewhere, and I haven't been able to find it, and of course, we talked about this. You don't remember where it is. I mentioned somewhere on some episode that my philosophy here is that we don't go back and change older show notes as a rule, as a philosophy, in that we keep them immutable. And so then if we have more information to add about an older episode, we would add that to the current show notes because, of course, we're talking about it on air in the current episode. Mm-hmm. And Wolf, you just went ahead and added it to the old one, which... you know, it's fine. It's fine. But so I'm going to add it to our show notes as well, just to keep things consistent as we can possibly be. And I have to say that maintaining these show notes is actually, it has been kind of nice in keeping me, just because I know that, like, you know, it kind of takes both of us to verify things, and I don't always want to bother you with stuff. And that does keep me from being too anal about, you know, changing things about the old show notes, because I will be going back and making things, you know, consistent through all the episodes in the past and everything. And, you know, nobody really wants that. Nobody cares except me. So I've saved myself some time, except for the 30 seconds it's taken me to describe it here. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so add that to these show notes as well. Okay, then I guess I better get on with it before we lose what remaining audience we have left. So as I described, I guess it was two episodes now, I have started a new job. And with a new job comes new code bases. And so I'd like to go over some things from that, in that topic. I'd like to go over, let's say, three things here. And one is how do I handle coming up on a new code base? Mm-hmm. And how do I recommend that all of our listeners, that other people handle it, getting to a new code base, having to deal with the new code base? And how do I recommend that you introduce someone else to a code base that you work on? Mm. And they're not all exactly the same thing, but they're all kind of related. And just to change things up, I'm actually, having said that in that order, I'm now going to reverse it and go to those in reverse order.
Flip it and reverse it. Wow.
Yes. So which is another one of the things that you might have to do during a job interview, but that was the last episode. So, no. Okay. So the first one is, you know, how do I recommend that you introduce someone else to a code base you're working on? And I wonder how many people in our audience have to deal with that. Certainly the more senior you become, the more experience you've had, the more likely you are to deal with something like this, to have your company, you know, bring in someone else and say, okay, they're going to work on this stuff that you worked on, and now you get to work on something new. So however familiar it is, however often it happens, I think it's worth talking about. Now, if it's a smaller code base, then, you know, who cares? If it's like a little tiny thing, the amount of time it will take for you to get up to speed is so trivial that it doesn't warrant spending a lot of time thinking about it. So I'm more thinking about substantial code bases, one or more apps, hundreds of files, you know, let's say a dozen major features to it, something where you really can't just take it in like a day or two. So let's say you've written most of the new features, or you've rewritten them. So you've gotten your scent on them, as we described in the Putting Your Scent on the Code, episode 44. And so they've got a new person on the team. They're going to take over the code base. What do I suggest that you do for that person to get that person up to speed in the best way possible? Well, I would say to start with assigning that person to bug fixing tasks. It's really the very best way to get up to speed on an existing code base. But now, not just any bug fixing. There's actually a sequence of bug fixing that I would recommend. So you want to start with the quick fix bugs. The bugs where it's basically go fix, go make this change. And so what you're really doing is having this other person do something that you just haven't had the time to do, but that you know what to do. So it's basically giving them instructions, an extra set of hands. For that, because that way you can say, you know what, go here, do these things. There's very little you can get wrong about that. You don't actually need to know that much about how the code works to do that. So ideally, you'd start with that. And then your next set of bugs to give that person is investigatory bugs, where you're saying, why is such and such happening? And you don't know. So you know where to point the new person to, but then they have to go in and figure it out, dig a little bit. The next thing that I would say to do on top of that, the third stage, is minor feature requests. Now, we all know, I hope we all know, that the way things work in code, in development cycles, is that you have, you know, your list of big features that you're going to work on. So you've got feature work as a stage in your development cycle. But then, you know, somebody says, okay, well, we need to get done with features by this date. And you say, okay, we'll get it done by that date. And whether you do or not is up to the project. I would say most of the time in projects, you don't quite hit it.
Right.
So you're scrambling a little bit to get things done. as quickly as you can. So what normally happens is that somebody arbitrarily says, okay, yes, the features are over. We're done with the features. But it's not really the end of the feature work, because all of the little things that are new functionality that are not, you know, giant features tend to get then reassigned as just straight up bugs. So you're still basically writing new code. You're not just fixing issues. But you know, you've kind of pushed them off a little bit. So I see that a lot. And it's still work that needs to get done. And it's above the stage of the other two phases that I've already mentioned. And it does get that person, that new person, starting writing more substantial code. And so they get to try out stuff. You're still probably overseeing them fairly closely, but they're finally kind of spreading their wings a little bit in the new code. So I find that to be a good next step. But now you're kind of blurring it. Are they really working on bugs? Are they working on features? Okay, so the next things that are in store are, I wouldn't consider to be bug fixes. They would be, you know, so then they've done sort of the very minor feature request. Okay, now give them some less minor feature requests. Still small, but more readily identifiable as features. So now let's say you've started the next development cycle. You're working on features. Well, give something small. Okay, well, then on top of that, then you give them something major. And that's really where they can start putting their own scent on the code, as we said, because they're working on something new. They're adding new code. They're probably going to do it in their own style. I mean, if they're smart, they are going to follow the style that's there, but they're likely going to start imposing more of their own organization on it than they were comfortable doing before. And then, of course, once they've done some major features on it, then they're probably ready to do major rewrites. So instead of now adding a significant code to a particular area, now they can go back to all of the entire code base and really rework things. And so that's really where they start to put their stamp on things, because then they're making the whole code base work the way they would want it to, or the way it should work, of course. So, you know, they may be dealing with a code base. I've pretty much always dealt with code bases where there were compromises made both in the design and the implementation of major pieces of it. So this is where they get a chance to make that better. Now, ideally, let's see here. As I said, the major new features and major rewrites would only come about at the beginning of the next cycle. So you should really have this person, in my experience, in my per my predilection, work on a full cycle, or at least a major portion of a cycle, before doing the major stuff on it. And what I've seen is, you know, maybe 3 to 6 months of time spent before they start to do the major stuff. So why would I say that? Why do I say that? Why not just have you work on it, work on the big stuff right away? Because when you're new to a code base, you don't know it. You don't really know it. Now, the word know in English, the verb to know, is actually, well, it gets like double duty or maybe triple duty or whatever, because you can know something but not know it. And this comes down, you know, okay, this comes down to the person that I said we weren't going to talk about anymore. But, you know, the Rumsfeld.
The who shall not be.
I'm going to say his name. Because Rumsfeld was kind of just trying to say a bit of this as well, in that there's different shades to knowing things. And I believe I have revealed in a previous episode that I do know German, or at least I used to know German. And in German, there are actually two verbs, or possibly three, depending on who you talk to, but two major verbs that both mean to know. There's wissen, which is to know a fact, and kennen, which I looks like I wrote on my note as kennel. Thanks, autocorrect. Kennen, which is to be more familiar with. And I'll put a link to something I found on via Google about those two verbs. And so it's the difference between kind of know and really know. To know versus be familiar with. And so, like, you know, if you were to say, well, you don't really know that man, you know, like, if you don't want to sound like the dude, but you want to make that distinction, you can make that easier in German by verb choice. Another way to describe it is, it's the difference between dating someone for months or years and having that first date with the person where you hear their life story. Now, in theory, if they're really detailed in telling you their life story, you will have all the same facts be conveyed to you even at that first date. But you won't have internalized it. And one way that I put it, which is a very programmery way to put it, is that you won't have made an internal model of that person in your head. Because it's only when you've made that internal model of that person or that code base or that place that you can do things like be able to predict how that person will react in certain areas to get us, you know, have off the cuff, know what that person likes and doesn't like. In terms of a code base, it's knowing how it will act under certain circumstances or knowing where to go to find things in it. And it doesn't mean know every detail about it. You're never going to do that. But again, you can, you know, you can tell that new person, oh, the search function. Oh, that's over here. Mm-hmm. So they don't have to go find it themselves. They don't have to spend all that time to find it. So what I'm really trying to do when I go through these steps for what for you should do for a coworker is give them a sequence of things to do to facilitate your coworker building that model in their own head and to avoid having that coworker make erroneous changes before acquiring that model. Because if you try to make changes before internalizing that model, it vastly increases the likelihood that they'll introduce bugs, sometimes very subtle bugs, that they wouldn't introduce once they knew it. And because the whole thing you're trying to avoid here is you're trying to avoid them making preventable mistakes. You're trying to avoid them causing more work in the long run than they might otherwise have to make. Now, of course, everyone makes bugs, but you know, bugs out of ignorance of how the code base works are really, you know, again, just things that you could have avoided. So that's it's a decent list of things I think that you could go through with someone else. Now, how would I recommend that you handle it if you're that person? And let's say no one's giving you the kind of guidance that I would recommend someone else give you.
Which would be the definite common case. It's more sink or swim, throw you in the code base.
It is. I'm hoping that I can walk people through how to handle this better.
No, this is good. I hadn't considered all this together, especially the kind of linear model you've described. I think it's really good stuff.
So the idea is then for yourself to how to get that model built up in yourself quickly. Let's see here. So I would start with coworkers, and actually you're probably going to be thrown at coworkers first anyway, regardless. What I've most found is that they'll say, if the person's still around, the person who did the code base before you, you know, you'll be told, okay, yeah, talk with so-and-so. So-and-so you walked you all through it. And sure, that's a good place to start. But it's like that first date scenario. They can tell you the whole story. And in fact, you know, maybe they could get you in a room and talk to you for hours and hours and hours and just pour out every little detail that they know. And it's still not going to be enough because you can't absorb all of that in one meeting. And I think that's something that people just don't get. Like, oh, let's have the handoff meeting. Okay. Thanks. And I think that's kind of a managerial issue. Like people think, oh, just have the meeting and then you'll be all set. And, you know, you probably already knew as a programmer that wasn't going to be enough, that you couldn't just, oh, now I'll just do everything in the code base that you require. But yeah, I think this kind of describes it a little better. This analyzes what's going on behind that. So there you go. And so you want to, another way to put it is like sort of dig the ruts in your own mind so that you have the patterns in there. So you, in addition to those meetings, in addition to that knowledge transfer, as the kids call it these days, you need to go over the code base repeatedly. Now, how do you go over the code base in a way that will facilitate this? Well, I have talked about it. I've talked about it in the Cocoa Squad episode, Maintenance in the Cocoa Squad, episode 14. And I'll put that link in the show notes as well.
To refer to yourself.
I know. This is all about previous episodes, basically.
It's our flashback episode.
It's our, what do you call it? It's the Clip Show episode.
That's exactly
what it is.
Yeah.
So
those only like 5 minutes of new content in this episode.
That's right. The rest of this is all from other episodes. So now why just skim? Why not just really dig into the code right away? And again, the idea is that you're just not going to remember all of it. If you dive into the code, if you try to dive into the code for the entire project, you'll just be, it'll all just go past you and you won't remember it. So if you do need to dive in the code, and actually you probably will, dive into a very small area. So that's why I mentioned before that you should take sort of start with the less ambitious bugs. Because you can start somewhere small, then you have more likelihood of actually imbibing that one area. And so if you look at a code base and there's things where you say, oh my God, that doesn't make any sense, obviously you should go back to coworkers for those bits that you understand. And then the coworker will tell me, oh, you know, I don't really remember. Well, so this is why as developers, you should comment those weird areas of the code that aren't self-explanatory, as I talked about in that episode. Because the less you as a newbie to the code have to go talk with someone, the faster you'll get used to things. And the less of other people's time you'll waste. But again, also, that, you know, again, that's the ideal world that they'll even remember. And most of the time, what I've seen is they don't remember. And so you go to them, you talk with them, and they're like, oh, all right, well, maybe. You know, like if they haven't looked at it in a month, very unlikely. And of course, if they haven't looked at it in 6 months, then you're even in more trouble. So then you've got to figure it out yourself, and that just takes a lot of time. But it's worth doing it, because if you don't understand what the code's doing, you know, you're very likely to make mistakes about it. And you do need to go over the code more than once. So you know, hopefully you can work on multiple bugs in the same area. So you're going over the code maybe a little differently each time. I had talked about, I believe I talked about this in the episode 46, Rectangles on a String, about cocoa bindings, auto layout.
give yourself away, conflate those two a little bit.
I believe I talked about in that area that where I liked receiving the same information from a second source because it let me verify it. It's like getting two different witnesses to a crime, right? As a police officer, you then get to verify that. Well, it's more likely that the parts that they share, even if they don't say it in exactly the same way, and of course it's better if they don't say it exactly the same way, because then that means they rehearse their story. So slightly different ways of getting the same information means it's more likely to be accurate. You're more likely to have understood that correctly. So, and that's, you know, I'll put that episode in the show notes as well. So once you go through the code more than once, maybe a little differently each time, maybe different code paths through the same class, you'll be verifying that information in your own mind.
And I'm just going to kind of glide over the fact that you go from first date to talking about crimes.
yes.
Let's glide right over that.
Lots of different metaphors in this. Or possibly it's all, you know, it's like, maybe the whole thing is like crime investigation, right? So they investigate, the murderer went on the first date and so on. Yeah. All right, moving on.
He's a CSI.
Yes. Yep. Special cases unit.
Yeah, we're definitely special cases. The short bus case.
Well, so after looking at, in addition to looking at the code, what other ways are there? In Xcode 2 and 3, there was something called the class modeling tool.
Which I love that tool. Well, really? I'm sorry. I always confuse that with the window, the other. The class modeler is the one that actually would read your source code and kind of like use Xcode's data modeler type thing, right?
It would give you a graph.
Yeah. I didn't like that as much.
Yeah. Well, thanks. So here's where I mentioned that I actually worked on it when I was at Apple.
All right.
Yeah. It had its problems. The biggest problem was that by default, it would make a model of your entire project, including framework classes, which would give you this giant, unreadable morass of lines.
Very much.
So what you actually wanted to do instead was create a model with just a few files in it, because it was based on files and the symbols that were inside those files. So if you just did it for a couple of files, you would get a graph, you would get a model of just those classes. And it would, you know, it would give you the hierarchy of the classes and it would put sort of the classes next to each other. And so I like that because it would give you an overview of just those related classes in a way that the class browser does not give you that. Because the class browser is, now there's the class browser in Xcode 2 and 3, and there's the symbol navigator in Xcode 4, And both of those give you a tree, basically, a tree view of all the classes, you know, stacked one on top of each other. And then, you know, that has its uses, and certainly in Xcode 4, it's they did it that way because they wanted to stuff it in that navigator area.
I always thought it was very optimistic of them to put it as the second facet right next to the file view.
Right. It's unlikely that most people are using that.
Right.
But I use it more now. It, you know, you can get a sense of one class hierarchy at a time that way. What you can't get is sort of several related class hierarchies that don't accidentally have the same, you know, starting letter in them. You know, so if you've got like lamp and bed, you know, light sources versus sleeping furniture, you know, you can't.
It's like you're looking inside my app, man.
Well, you know, those are going to be pretty far apart if you've got a lot of other classes, so you can't look at them both together in the way that you could have with the class modeling tool. So that's why I'm not a big fan of it. But there are a couple things that you can do. If you right-click on a method or property, there's an option, show in Symbol Navigator, as opposed to the other option, reveal in Symbol Navigator. So, maybe they need a bit of consistency there. But if you do that, and there's a couple of different methods in your class hierarchy, like several different places where you override a method, it will sort of filter the class hierarchy such that you only see those method names underneath the class hierarchy. And that, again, that's another way of giving you an overview of some things. And so then you can say, oh, very quickly you can see who overrides it. And if you have a pretty deep hierarchy or a pretty, you know, a lot of classes, even if it's not deep, a broad hierarchy, whatever, it's nice to be able to see that instead of having to traipse through a lot of code to see that all in one little section of the Xcode UI. And so I've done that when I want to see what subclasses override a method. And there's also in Project Search, and I don't know when they added this. I don't think it was like in the beginning in Xcode 4.0. There's now a symbol definition search. Wolf, have you heard of this?
No, I'm actually looking at it right now.
Well, there's symbol definitions. I'm sorry. The one that I really wanted to mention was there's symbol definitions, which is decent, and there's also symbol references.
Okay.
And symbol references, I mean, it seems to work from what I've tried. I'm not used to using it. And I knew that was actually something that some of the one that Peter Hosey likes, the app code. That's right.
Yeah.
So, and we did a reference, we did an episode about app code as well. Let's see if I can find that pretty quickly here. A little slice of Windows in my IDE, episode 12. And so I found that I was not a big fan of it because it really felt like a Windows application inside mm-hmm. my Mac. But the thing that people were saying that was better about AppCode was that it had a lot better symbol navigation and search in it. And it seems mm-hmm. like Xcode is attempting to catch up at least a little bit with reference search. Because what you would want to be able to do with reference search is find uses of properties, you know, the set foo and foo, which you wouldn't necessarily be able to find with a straight text search.
Right.
And actually, I don't have Xcode open right now. I don't know if it does that. Actually, Wolf, can you do a quick search on that to see if that works?
Oh, what am I looking for?
Like search on a property.
Okay.
Do you use symbol reference search on a property and see if it gets the set, you know, set foo in addition to the foo.
I'm not sure where this symbol reference search you're talking about. Are you talking about under the search navigator?
In the search navigator, and you say types of search, that little tiny disclosure thing.
I don't have that. This is Xcode whatever the last four is.
I don't think I was accidentally opening Xcode 5. maybe I was. Oops, sorry. Well, actually, I did have a thing in my notes saying, you know,
don't talk about this.
Well, saying that there were. There were new things in Xcode 5 that you would be able to see. But I thought I was only talking about Xcode 4. Actually, you know what? No, this is definitely Xcode 4. All right, fine. I'll just open it up myself here. And this is Xcode 4.6.3. What do you have?
I am on Xcode 4.6.3. So apparently, I'm just not, I don't know what
you Yeah, you go to find, you know, Command-Shift-F. And then in the search bubble, there's mm-hmm. that widow disclosure thing,
yeah.
which says show find options, and then style. There's textual, regular expression, symbol definitions, and symbol references. You don't see that?
Hang on. I busily tried to install run Xcode 5, the latest developer preview, to see what you're seeing, but now you jumped over to back to 4. So
no, it's definitely 4.6.3.
Okay, so I see. Show find options. Oh, okay, yeah. I've run into this when Xcode 4 first had this, but I've never visited since, so I forgot it's even here.
Let's see.
Okay, nice. So for those playing at home, to this confused little thing we're doing. So you go under the search navigator in the left-hand side, then in the little text area where you type in the thing that you actually want to search for, by the magnifying glass, there's a menu called Show Find Options, and next to that is a style that allows you to actually search by symbol definitions or symbol references.
Yep. That was kind of cool. We don't usually explore Xcode live during our episodes. But in any case,
when you only need to create 5 minutes of content, this is what you do. You tell people that you're walking through UI.
Yes. In any case, I do have more to talk about, so let's move on. So in addition to those ways of looking at the code, looking at the symbolic information about your project, the next thing I had listed was design documents.
And
this is another one of the things where it might be helpful, but don't over-rely on it, because they're usually going to be out of date if you're coming onto a project later. So I would never rely on them alone. Always verify information with coworkers. And that's actually true with going to talk with people as well. You should probably never just rely on one person if there's another person involved that you can also ask about. And I've had this happen, and I've actually had this happen quite recently, where I talked with one person and they seemed very clear. Okay, no, that's this. This is all you need to know. And I find out a day later, after I've spent a day on it, no, you actually should have, this other person had more information to do. So, learn from my mistakes. Pretty much always talk with other people if you can. Now, of course, that's an ideal world. In an ideal world, everybody has everybody else's information. But do what you can. Anyway, obviously you don't necessarily want to bother everybody all the time, but especially, if it's something where you're like, okay, this is going to take a day, maybe that, as opposed to something that will only take 5 minutes, then I would definitely recommend double checking if at all possible. Mm-hmm. Another thing that you might want to look at is unit tests.
I'm glad you brought that up. That was on my list of things to bring up.
Yeah. And of course, I talked about unit tests in episode 26. You can't run a script to test feel. So how many references are we up to now? Maybe 5?
This is definitely breaking a record.
And that's all. All of my episodes from now on will just be rehashing stuff from older episodes. But the problem with unit tests is if they're simple enough for you to read clearly, they probably don't actually include that much useful information that can't be skimmed from looking at the code base. And if they do contain a lot of concentrated data, then they become extremely hard to read. I think I even joked about them being sort of a write-only medium. Mm-hmm. Because if the data is really packed in there in a way that lets you run these tests lets you test a lot of cases, a large portion of the matrix of potential test cases in a minimum amount of time, with a minimum amount of writing code, then they're probably pretty hard to decipher. Mm-hmm. Because what you would really need is sort of the thought process that went into those tests.
Right.
And if you were to write down, as let's say code comments or readme file, all of the thinking that went into those tests, then that's paragraphs of comments, which is also probably not something that you really want to do. You don't necessarily want to spend the time on that. You don't want to clutter the code with that. Mm-hmm. So unit tests might only be of sort of limited help. And so what I would suggest then, if you are coming to the code, is, and you don't understand the unit tests, just kind of leave them. Write your own unit tests on top of the ones that are there. So that, even if you're then duplicating effort, it shouldn't really hurt things, right? Because it's more a way of understanding the code base, getting to know the code base, rather than, being picture perfect, completely efficient about these things. And again, they're just testing the same thing in different ways. And as I've discussed in that episode, it is unlikely that those tests will actually fail in code which is not being worked on anymore. I mean, maybe you found cases where that does happen. I haven't. So again, you probably won't really be making more problems with yourself with a bunch of tests failing. But that's really the most that I can say for that. Again, I haven't found.
Mm-hmm. I would use more of the seatbelt analogy there. That it's not something. I agree with you that kind of reading unit tests directly to try to understand how the code works isn't going to. And typically, is the return on investment is not going to be great. But in terms of it catching dumb mistakes as you fix these bugs, that's where it comes in.
Right. Right. So I think that's about it for sort of the second thing that I mentioned talking about. So now kind of moving on to the third and final section, which is, so the first one was actually going back up here. The first one was, how do I recommend you interview someone else? The second one was, how I recommend you handle it. And now, you know, what would I do about this stuff? And this isn't necessarily stuff that I would recommend you do. It's just my own experience on top of that, but maybe it will be. We'll see. In a lot of cases, and as you said, like generally you're kind of thrown in to the code base. Okay, hey, get used to it. You know, we don't have time to talk to you about it. Go get used to it. What I have found in a lot of cases is that you're going to be pushed hard to do things fast. And, you know, when I talked about the ideal schedule, you know, maybe 3 to 6 months, an entire developer cycle for you to get up to speed on the code base, you know, you're probably not going to be given that luxury. If you are, take it. But you probably aren't. You know, most of the time when I come into a new company, you know, they're hiring me because they need something done rapidly. Mm-hmm. And so they need an extra body to do it. So you can probably work faster than my ideal schedule. But I would say don't let them push you too far. That's kind of where I'm at. Like if somebody were to, actually somebody did say relatively recently, you know, hey, this code was not necessarily written the way we wanted it to. If you want to rewrite it, you know, go ahead. And this was in my first week looking at the code. Now, I actually think the person who gave me that comment listened to the podcast. So, hi. So, you know, I'm not saying like, oh my God, they shouldn't have said that, because it wasn't said like, you know, you should, you know, rewrite the code base today. But I will say, you know, so I'm more kind of mentioning it just as an educational opportunity here, in that was one of the things where I kind of pushed back, where I said, you know, no, the first week is not an appropriate time for me to be rewriting anything. You know, I'm going to be looking at the code base, me doing that, but that's just not a good idea. So that wasn't really a push, but, you know, that's my example that I have on that. So I guess it's actually good that I don't have a specific example of someone pushing me too hard. But that's what I got.
Yeah, so while we're on that topic, I agree that is definitely not the topic you want. You don't want to have that frame of mind when you're reading a code base, especially for the first time and you're going in, because you're ignorant of the fact of all the edge cases and even the problem domain of what this code does. Yep. And the first instinct you have is, what is all this crap? Wouldn't it be simple, right, simpler if I just write it myself? Yep. Or rewrite the world, right? And we often refer to him, but Joel Spolsky had a good article on this. It was called Things You Should Never Do, Part 1. And I'll throw you a link to it so you can throw that in the show notes. Cool. And he talks about Netscape rewriting.
I remember
from
version
5 or version 6 or whatever. And he mentioned that this is, you know, that you look at this very twisted, gnarled code and you're like, oh my God, why?
Yep.
Like, we are so much smarter now. We know all these, and it, you know, you can talk yourself into it, right? Because it's like, we know all these issues now. So we have a higher understanding. So now we can lay down better architecture. And he points out how disastrous that is. And unfortunately, I don't want to attribute it all to ego, but it's definitely something where it's like you're looking at, because you know how the app operates typically, and then you see this gnarled code, and you're like, it doesn't have to be like this. It could be simpler. But the thing is, you don't actually know you don't know the history. You don't know all the bug fixes. And it's quite possible that initially the code was to your kind of platonic ideal of what the code should be, but then reality stepped in, right? And so that is a very dangerous mindset when you're learning the code. So I have to agree with you that was a good thing you pushed back on, that don't go into the – I would very much typically go in – when you learning a new code base, don't assume you get to rewrite everything you don't like. That be kind of assume a humble standpoint.
Yes. code zen. the highest – status of your code, the highest mental state is what, so the highest mental state is coming back to that point, coming back around to, I know this code base well enough to know what actually can be rewritten and what should be rewritten, as opposed to what I might think at first glance should be rewritten. Like really knowing what should be rewritten and knowing you're right about that, that's when, you know, that's when you're the master. That's when you're ready to do that stuff. Of course, that's also probably when you're burned out and you want to move on to something entirely new, but yeah, there you go. Let's see, more stuff that I wrote down here. What I do is I take copious notes at the beginning of a project. And these notes are also basically write-only, like unit tests. I'm probably not going to come back to them in 6 months and find anything useful in there. Because what you do when you do that is you're tracing this very narrow track through the code. And you don't even realize where you're making that track when you're doing it. You're just blindly, you know, finding your way through. So it's not even that good as a future reference, because if I want to come back and say, oh, hey, I wrote down some stuff about this code area, you know, I should be able to find out this information that now I need to know, you know, 6 months later. Well, you probably won't find it because you were writing down a very narrow path. So don't think of it as something, a later resource. Just use it as what you need right now, because what you're doing is you're imbibing, you're at the fire hose, you're getting all this information. You're not going to remember it all, but you're going to need to remember it for the next, you know, 2 or 3 days. For each bug you work on, you're going to need to remember about a day or 2 days worth of that information. And the only way to do that is to write it down. So write it down. Don't be afraid of writing it down, the same information multiple times in slightly different ways. Again, because you learn more each time you go through it. That's been very helpful to me. Another thing is write some initial bugs. Write some bugs before you should be writing bugs. You're almost certainly to get stuff wrong when you write the bugs. A lot of those bugs will be closed. They'll say, no, really, you know, okay, no, we intended that. Or just somebody else is working on that right now, you know, so closed as duplicate, whatever. But the corrections you get when you write those bugs, I think are generally worth it. And it's also a very low-cost way of getting those corrections. You know, again, if you only get those corrections 3 months later when someone else is trying to decipher, you know, the bug fixes you made that were wrong, that's high cost. But somebody reading your bug and saying, no, that's not quite what we need, that's pretty low cost. And it also, you know, bug triage generally goes to the people who know what they're doing, hopefully, right? So then your mistakes are getting to the right people very quickly. And it also helps increase your visibility in an organization. Hey, this is the person who's writing all these bugs. So that can help you as well. And I think the final thing, well, the second final thing, is find your go-to people. Now, these may not be the ones that you think they would be on the org chart. Maybe it's another newbie who's only a little bit ahead of you, but is really good at finding stuff, or just, you know, really, really helpful and really able to spend time with you at a time when other people are not. Maybe it's a designer or a PM, or maybe it's a developer nominally in another unrelated part of the organization that you would never otherwise have thought to go talk to. But that person, like right now, that's the best person to go to for information. You know, look around, cast as wide a net as you can to find that person. And then, you know, once you find him, rely on him and for what you need. I think that can be very helpful. And that's been helpful for me. And I guess the final thing is, you know, just don't get discouraged. And so that is not something that I normally do. I actually tend to, you know, you get those lows and highs, right? When you, oh my God, I'll never figure this out. Or, you know, hey, I know everything. And then, you know, you go down the next trough and you go down the next, whatever. So I guess a better way to put that is, you know, just be prepared for the roller coaster, because it's going to happen. You got to go through it. Because if you're not going through it, you're not learning. You're not making progress. But if you do go through it, you know, it'll be a little painful for a while. But it's part of getting up to speed on things is making those mistakes, is going down those blind alleys, is finding the points where you don't think you're doing really well at it. And then, you know, at some point you'll be through all of that. To take this analogy further than it should be, you know, you've gotten through the stormy seas and now you're on the, you know, calm seas later on. And it'll all work out. So I think that's most of what I have to say here. Wolf, any more reactions?
Right. A couple of points. Number one is that you talk about coming upon a new code base, but one of the aspects of that you didn't mention is how often it might be you coming upon the code base you've already written, right? So it's a project that's been on the shelf for a couple of years and you're basically reintroducing yourself. So it's just, so you may be the person on both ends of the stick, which is, I don't know, I think a primer reference or something. I don't know. But so that, I mean, that's, so it's, I really, that's where I really liked it, kind of like your linear explanation of how you can do things. And yeah, and hopefully then your, maybe your little high level graphs will be more up to date. And so you can reintroduce yourself to the same project. But I don't want to delve into that too much, but I guess three things then. The other thing that is, for me, it's more of an issue of the symbol navigator and the class browser type stuff. That's really great in terms of hierarchies, but hierarchies for me tend to tell very little of the story. And for me, it's more of how classes collaborate.
Yep.
And that's something that's not automated whatsoever in Xcode.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's something that AppCode can do. That'd actually be pretty sweet if it could. But
I don't think it has any graphing capabilities for that, any visual capabilities, but I could be wrong.
And especially if you write kind of like single responsibility type of classes where they're all very focused and they all kind of collaborate with each other, those type of webs of collaborating classes can be very intricate. And there's a definite trade-off there. And I, for one, have been able to use OmniGravel. That's kind of sketch out who knows about what and what responsibilities are. And that's been very effective. But of course, then it's very subject to bit rot. And as you add new classes in the face of new changes and all that, that's that often doesn't stay up to date. So that's a double-edged sword, but that's been effective for me.
Well, but it can still be useful for you to having those snapshots. Again, it's like the notes that I'm talking about.
Sure.
You're taking, they're useful for the time they're useful for, and that's fine. That's okay. Fun.
And that was a good segue to the notes because that was my final reaction here. So I'm totally on board with, you know, writing down notes as you're exploring things, and don't think that they are these archive of wisdom that you will be passed down from generation to generation. You should view it as almost a write-only type thing. That said, I have had great experiences with a variant of that where as I'm writing down my questions and answers – I use a very simple format for kind of calling out my questions that, and then finding out what my open questions are and then answering them. Is that I just have a text file like you that as I go through, I ask the questions. I just put a double question mark in front of each sentence of like, you know, what does this class do or why would it be doing that? And then as I learn more and more, I end up filling out the next line. I put a double exclamation mark next on the next line, kind of answering my own question. And I found, you say that, you know, that you don't tend to go back to these notes, but I've actually found myself going back to these notes and searching for that question. Like, oh, you know, I had that question, you know, 3 months back. And like, I think I found the answer to that. And that actually has had some, I don't, my cache hit ratio there is pretty low, probably maybe 10%, but it's been effective. And where those previous, and it's not that much structure to add to the note. And it has been, and I think it's worth the very minimal structure I've added to the notes that it has been effective in terms of finding those questions and answers that I've had as I've explored a code based. So I would throw that little token of knowledge and nugget of wisdom into the mix as well.
Sure.
And that's it.
That's it. Okay. Cool. So to see the show notes for this episode, go to edgecasesshow.com, all one word, /60, and we'll see you next time.